From coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa. I'm Yvette Thompson.
And I'm Morgana Folkman. Has someone ever told you when you threw a small piece of litter on the ground or left the lights on? What if everyone did that?
What kind of feeling does this reaction get from you? Do you feel anger and shame? Do you feel motivated to modify your behavior? In this week's show, we ask a big question. How much of an effect can we really have at an individual level?
You know, we're often distracted by fads and the sexier, sleeker new gadgets when it comes to improving our energy efficiency, for example. Trevor Chow Fraser explores how we can simply change behavior to confront climate change in his conversation with Craig Isikow of WeGoWise. We'll get to that later in the show.
But first, I'd like to issue a challenge. Try to make it 60 seconds without using anything made out of plastic. Sounds easy enough, right? Oh, just don't forget about your glasses, the phone, volume dial, computer, the linoleum floor, maybe the carpet, your coffee cup. Maybe you see where I'm going with this. Short of moving into the woods, it's virtually impossible to live 100% plastic-free year, let alone a lifetime. But that didn't stop one BC woman from trying. Hamdi Essawi brings you this story.
It is everywhere. I mean, it's around us, it's on us, and it's in us. So it is absolutely everywhere. So if you stop and just look around, you'll start to really see it, you know, because it's become so pervasive, it's virtually invisible.
This is Taina Huito.
I live on Denman Island in British Columbia, and I do my best to live a plastic-free life.
But it wasn't always that way.
Back in 2009, I was working as the manager of a sustainable seafood program. So I had my eye on the ocean, so to speak. And so I started learning a little bit about plastic pollution in the ocean through a program called Five Gyres.
Five Gyres is an environmental organization bent on eliminating plastic pollution in our oceans. They're named after the five huge swirling vortices in the Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Oceans.
Think of like a giant toilet bowl that's kind of flushing. And right in that middle is where you get a lot of accumulation of all the stuff that's coming from land or that ends up in the ocean. So where does our plastic go in the ocean? Well, it ends up in these areas called the gyres. Some people think that they're islands of garbage, but what it is actually plastic soup.
Now, because the gyres are so vast, the ocean plastic floats all around and at different depths, so it's hard to even estimate just how much plastic there is out there. But to give you an idea of how much plastic we make, the United States Environmental Protection Service pegs plastic waste generated in 2012 at 32 million tons, only 9% of which was recovered for recycling, which is a whole other problem.
So if you think about the vast accumulation that is occurring on our planet, it's pretty mind-boggling.
We've all seen how plastic waste, like six-pack rings, can harm sea animals. But what you might not know is that over time, the sun's rays help break that plastic down into smaller pieces, which is not exactly a good thing either. As plastic stews in the ocean water, chemicals added during the manufacturing process, like BPA, can leach into and contaminate the surrounding water. On top of that, some plastics, like polyethylene, act as magnets that attract and accumulate other waterborne toxins, like PCB and the pesticide DDT. It all spells out bad news for any birds or sea life that might mistake small bits of plastic for an easy meal. These problems, along with other concerns about the limited recyclability of plastics, prompted Taina to quit plastic for a whole year.
A week or a month just didn't seem long enough. So I kind of decided to go big and do a full year, and the main goal was to acquire no new plastics, and then to purge my kitchen and bathroom of all plastic products. So on day one, January 1st, I made a big, ugly plastic pile in the middle of my kitchen, and out the door it went. So that's how it all began.
And it's been like that ever since.
I would say that after, you know, almost 4 years of doing it, I think I'm at like 98% plastic free.
Which isn't to say that there were no hiccups along the way. Like with any challenge, it wouldn't be much of one if it was easy.
With plastic free, you often have to compromise. You can't be set on certain things always. You can't be like, today I want an apple. You know, you might have to go and get a pear instead if you find that the pears have no stickers and the apples do. And so, you know, you're always kind of juggling, but you do have to kind of stay open about the possibilities.
And that works both ways. The sheer ubiquity of plastics make an all-or-nothing approach virtually impossible. Hence the need for a few ground rules. The first being...
health comes first, before the plastic challenge. So if I absolutely needed, for example, some kind of medication, and it came in plastic, and I wasn't going to beat myself up for it. So my advice there would be just, you can get caught up on a lot of stuff if you're too picky. So if you make these rules and you allow yourself a few vices or whatever, then you'll do a lot better because it's crazy.
If possible, plastic-free is always Tina's first choice, which has led to some interesting alternatives.
One of my favorite alternatives is this thing called an Abigo wrap. It's basically a piece of cloth that's covered in beeswax. And what it does is it replaces saran wrap, for example. Okay, so toothbrush, you can... I have several, it's because I'm a total geek. But the one that I was using first was made out of bone and boar hairs.
Her solution to garbage bags, to me anyway, was the most impressive. Though I suppose it really shouldn't have come as a surprise.
I had never really thought about what I was going to do with garbage bags. But what we found going through the challenge is we weren't creating any garbage, or very little garbage, because you cut out plastic, then you cut out a lot of the other junk that comes with plastic. Then, you know, we had so little garbage that we're able to get away with using just little paper bags.
Though she hasn't found a way around credit cards and the new polymer banknotes, living plastic-free has made her life richer in other ways.
You learn to talk to people, and you learn to ask for help, and you learn to ask for what you want. And just kind of leading the way feels good too. I love talking to elementary school groups about this and connecting to those kids. And yeah, it's brought a lot of good in that way for sure.
For Terra Informa, I'm Hamdi Essaoui.
That was Hamdi Essaoui speaking to Tina Awito about her plastic-free life. He reached her by phone in Denman Island, BC. A documentary chronicling Tina's challenge is due for release this April. It's called From the Waist Up. To watch the trailer and learn more about her project, visit her website, plasticmatters.com.
Tina seems like a mighty conscious consumer. She's absolutely taken the reins and looked at her individual actions. Yvette, how many times have you used plastic in the last 24 hours?
I honestly wouldn't even be able to count. Probably 20 times today so far, at least.
Okay, and how many times have you thought about shutting off the lights?
Lots. It's a matter of awareness, I suppose. Our next story is all about the power of suggestion.
So how does an environmental awareness campaign drive us to actually change our behaviors? Does turning off the tap, shutting off the lights, or taking reusable grocery bags really contribute to the global good? Or more importantly, how seriously do we take our individual roles in mitigating the changing climate? World Wildlife Fund's International Earth Hour campaign asks you and I to cut the lights, shut down the power, and think about the repercussions. Yvette Thompson investigates how Earth Hour is creating dialogue about energy use and how WWF is using the light switch as its poster child for change.
Many of us have been faithfully turning off our lights during Earth Hour every year. Maybe you've been at it since 2008, when Earth Hour spread to more than 4,000 cities worldwide. And Earth Hour is pulling even more than the regularly scheduled 60 Minutes of Fame this year. After several years of encouraging the simple flick of a switch, World Wildlife Fund is hoping to create a bigger splash through their global and national Earth Hour campaigns. The new World Wildlife Fund Canada campaign, Moment of Darkness, encourages citizens to tweet or record videos about what they will be thinking about during their hour without electricity. The brilliance of Kevin Spacey in House of Cards, calling for a pizza, climate change? Opening the door to these social media avenues is not a new technique for WWF. However, it does call for deliberate consideration. So we literally sit in the dark and think about what should, could, or needs to be done. The World Wildlife Fund's exercise in citizen engagement caused me to think, too. Is this campaign helping to further the conversation on climate change? And what do people actually think about Earth Hour after 6 years? With over 12,000 followers of Earth Hour Canada on Twitter alone, people have got to know about this, right? I took to the streets of Edmonton to find out. Are you planning on participating in Earth Hour this year on March 29th?
Yeah, I think it'll be a cool thing to do.
So what do you plan to be thinking about during your moment of darkness?
Ooh, in my moment of darkness, I'll be thinking about how we as a people can get together, start a movement on making a better Earth for everyone.
What do you think you're going to be thinking about while you have your hour without power?
Well, I will be thinking about how happy I am I have candles, but I'll also be thinking about all of the people in the world who are having a difficult time because of the pollution.
Do you feel any sense of Earth Hour fatigue, being that this is the sixth year that we've been working through Earth Hour?
I don't feel any fatigue at all from participating in the sixth Earth Hour. I think that I feel rejuvenated, if anything else, because now I'm in the routine of practicing Earth Hour. I know it's coming up every year. More and more people are becoming aware of it. And it's wonderful. It's no fatigue at all.
So what do you think you're going to be thinking about during your moment of darkness or your hour without any power?
I think I'll be mainly thinking about ways that I can kind of maintain the Earth Hour perspective throughout the rest of the year. So finding ways that we can use less power more effectively.
And do you think that you'll be considering the impacts of electricity use on climate change during the hour?
For sure, absolutely. I think that that's the main message that's spread throughout Earth Hour. So realizing that even though we as Edmontonian citizens don't necessarily see the direct impacts of climate change because of electricity use, we have to keep in mind that it's happening and it's coming, and if anything, we'll notice it in the next 10, 20 years.
WWF's campaign is shedding light on values. For many people, including Rain Maida, all of this awareness building may feel like a consistently skipping record. Rain's video contribution to the Moment of Darkness campaign echoes the plight of many engaged citizens in their efforts towards sustainability. We might be individually walking the talk, but climate change is not about to fix itself. We have to work together. So as part of the expanded Earth Hour campaign, WWF is taking energy reduction to City Council. The We Love Cities campaign is an offshoot of the Earth Hour City Challenge, where Vancouver was named global winner in 2013. Urban areas account for more than 70% of global CO2 emissions, says WWF. Statistics Canada suggests 81% of the Canadian population lives in urban centers, and that was as of 2011. The city holds the basic needs to life: access to food, public and alternative transportation systems, water management, and shelter. It's all right there. WWF Canada President and CEO David Miller spoke to me about the power of municipalities in creating fundamental shifts towards a sustainable world.
World Wildlife Fund is about nature. It's
yeah.
about preserving species and their habitat and their wonderful biodiversity that not only inspires us as humans, but allows us to live. And the biggest challenge to nature today is climate change. So from my perspective, what WWF is going to be about moving forward is about finding solutions to the biggest challenges threatening nature. And that's kind of the collision between our environment and our economy. That produces climate change, that produces overfishing, fishing. So we're involved with cities because that's where solutions are happening on many of these issues. There are innovative programs, great thinking, and real change on the ground. You know, we'd like to influence national governments as well, but internationally they've tied themselves in knots trying to reach an absolute 100% consensus. Cities aren't waiting. So what we want to do is showcase what cities are doing as examples of good practice to inspire others to act. And we also want to work with urban residents to help reconnect them with nature. So they'll be re-inspired and help support the actions of their city governments.
David Miller, former mayor of Toronto, was in Edmonton in early March as part of the Out of the Dark and Into the Future tour. That tour heads to Halifax and Toronto later this month. Edmonton has been recognized as Canada's Earth Hour City Capital this year. Edmonton is seen as a leading green city based on the Way We Green Comprehensive Sustainability Plan that was created in 2011. David's vision of World Wildlife Fund's role in the future is to engage the public in getting back to nature. Along with this vision is the creation of clear energy directives. The vision for WWF Canada is to see renewables take the forefront in the near future. They are calling for a world running on 100% renewable energy by 2050. Andy Ridley, CEO and co-founder of Earth Hour, has been creatively addressing the changing atmosphere of the environmental campaign. In a recent TEDxWWF talk on the subject, Andy suggested that Earth Hour is much more than just the light switch. It's a jumping-off point. It is a platform to create sustainable conversation and collaborative action. This year, WWF Global is taking on a new Earth Hour Blue campaign. Blue for the beauty of Earth from space. So I guess it isn't just all about the lights. Earth Hour Blue is calling for donations for projects, including the Canadian-led 100% renewable energy goal, through an online crowdsourcing platform. Earth Hour is on March 29th this year, from 8:30 to 9:30, all your own local time. Of course, go ahead and tweet Moment of Darkness, all one word, to get involved online. For Terra Informa, this is Yvette Thompson.
That was Yvette Thompson speaking with David Miller and some enthusiastic Edmontonians. David is the current president and CEO of World Wildlife Fund Canada. For more information on Earth Hour and WWF's campaigns, check out wwf.ca and earthhour.org. Those links will be available on our website, terrainforma.ca.
Earth Hour is on March 29th this year. I know I'll be wining and dining by candlelight, and of course, thinking about my impact on the environment.
With some organic wine and locally grown vegetables?
Of course.
Check out our website for details on the stories that you've heard today, terrainforma.ca.
And a big shout out to our listeners on CICK Smithers, BC, and CJUC The Juice in Whitehorse, Yukon Territory. When it comes to cutting-edge green technology, some things are just way sexier than others. Tesla's Model S electric car, that's sexy. A sweeping line of wind turbines rising over a rugged tree-lined ridge, that's kind of sexy too. Philips' new urban beehive, it looks like an orange twist encased in a sleek little spaceship. That is super sexy. But while fancy gadgets like these hog the limelight, we're missing a really big piece of the energy puzzle. We're talking about simply saving electricity. Using energy more efficiently can have a much bigger and immediate impact when it comes to tackling climate change. So when our reporter Trevor Trow Fraser was in Washington earlier this winter, he went straight to the office of Craig Izakow. He's part of a company that's on the forefront of making energy efficiency the sexy issue that it needs to be.
Think back to when you were just a kid. What were some of the first lessons you learned about saving the environment? For me, it was all about running water, not letting the water run while brushing my teeth, not having 15-minute long showers, and then, too, always turning off the lights when leaving the room.
Crazy. Drives me crazy. I don't know. If I'm the last one to leave this office, I turn all the lights off, and there's 200 people here. Nobody else turns them off, so...
That's Craig Izakow.
Hi, this is Craig Izakow. I am the Director of Commercial Solutions with WeGoWise. We bring energy efficiency to commercial and multifamily buildings.
Craig doesn't work at WeGoWise, though. He works in a co-sharing space with hundreds of other tech entrepreneurs in Washington, D.C. The rest of his company works in Boston, and they're all helping us remember those early environmental lessons about saving water and electricity. Energy efficiency for buildings may not be the sexiest issue, but take one look at the website of WeGoWise, and you might change your mind.
We've developed a very easy-to-use software that captures your utility bills, compares your buildings to others, and tells you how you can improve to save energy. I'd love to give you a display, and I don't know if it makes sense to walk through, but what you'd see if you had our product, the first screen you'd see is your portfolio. And so let's say you're an owner that owns a lot of buildings. You'd see dots across a screen. And each dot represents the spend for that building and the amount of energy it uses per square foot. And in the top right, we put all your worst buildings, your most expensive and your least efficient. And in the bottom left, we put all your best buildings, your least expensive and most efficient. And so when you're an owner, you can quickly see where you need to spend your efforts. If you click on one of those dots, then what you see is a benchmark. We compare you to over 17,000 buildings in our database to say, how do you compare on water, electric, gas, and oil? In fact, that's why our name is WeGoWise, because we track water, electric, gas, and oil, WEGO-WISE. That helps you understand, are all my buildings bad? Are all my buildings good? Because at first, we're only comparing them to itself. Then finally, once you take an action, you can use our software to track it over time. Did you save energy or not once you upgraded your boiler, once you put in new insulation, and understand how much money you saved? So that's how people use our software.
It certainly is a handsome-looking product. But why is it important? For many, energy efficiency is a neglected but crucial issue when it comes to addressing climate change.
Like, why should we pursue efficiency instead of renewable energy or something like that?
That is a terrific question. And I would go on record saying you're absolutely crazy if you don't go after efficiency first. If you're going, let's say you use 100 megawatts of electricity for your community. If you decide to go to solar and you put in 100 megawatts before you go efficient, then you've wasted your money. You have more energy than you need. So the first thing you always have to do, whether it's your house or your business, is do efficiency first. The cleanest kilowatt is a kilowatt you didn't use, right? And so really efficiency is should be everyone's first step.
So what if you want to take this first step? If you're a homeowner or manage commercial property or institutional space, what can you do to start making your buildings more energy efficient?
So, the biggest upgrades we've seen is boiler replacements, insulation upgrades, and then water upgrades, actually. So people putting in low flow faucets, things like that. In people's homes, the number one thing they should do is probably insulate their ceiling. That's what we've seen in our portfolio.
And those are just the technological upgrades. A lot of efficiency can be gained from simply changing the way you operate.
It's something they call retrocommissioning, which is basically having the building perform the way it was designed to perform. So you can spend a lot of money getting LEED approved or Green Globes approved buildings, but if you don't operate them correctly, making sure that you're turning, they call setbacks, turning the heat back at night. Even if you have a very well-built building, you could still waste a lot of energy.
All of this points to an interesting distinction between renewable energy and energy efficiency. Renewable energy is all about the source, about displacing and replacing dirty coal power plants. But since it all happens at the source, in many ways, renewables don't change the way that we live. Energy efficiency is different. These changes tap into the ways we live in and use our buildings. There are important human dimensions to generating energy efficiency.
We were founded by a company called New Ecology, which retrofits affordable housing, by an investment group called Boston Community Capital that invests in affordable housing. And they came together and said, how can we prove that efficiency actually works so we can get more money invested in affordable housing to give people not only a more efficient building, but also a more comfortable building, so that people aren't too hot or too cold. Unfortunately, a lot of time you go buy public housing, you'll see windows open in the winter because it's just overheated. Or you'll see the opposite, space heaters, because it's not heated enough. Efficiency is tied with tenant comfort. And so
you might call that human error, but it's really all about the systems we do or do not have in place to properly manage our building's energy.
I think the biggest visible sign of inefficiency is when you're downtown and you see all the office lights on 24 hours a day.
Drives me crazy. I don't know. If I'm the last one to leave this office, I turn all the lights off. You know, I think it's a weird cultural thing that people leave the lights on. A lot of that has to do with operations. So, for example, when I used to work at the U.S. Department of Energy, the cleaners came through during the day. And when I first started, I'm like, why is a person emptying the trash can in the middle of my meeting? It seemed strange. But the reason was is because if you do cleaning during the day, then you can turn all the lights off. Oftentimes, the office buildings have the lights on because the cleaning crews come through at night.
Changing work schedules, responding to occupant needs, responding more efficiently to the changing seasons. Optimizing these processes can make big impacts, practically for free. All in all, energy efficiency promises to deliver significant carbon savings. Worldwide, buildings account for a third of energy consumption. The United Nations Environment Program recently called for greater business leadership on this issue. It's a $300 billion investment opportunity, just waiting for the right people to arrive.
My background was pretty traditional. I went to Michigan, I had an engineering degree, and then I actually moved to China. Just seeing the growth in China and the pollution, I went to the Three Gorges Dam where they were flooding the countryside and moving over 1 million people. They had built this giant dam to power the country. That's when I really realized that if I wanted to make an impact in my life and also have a career that was profitable, that finding ways to solve these energy issues would be a good path. So I've committed to the environment, committed to, you know, being a capitalist, and committed to, you know, making a difference, hopefully make money and make a difference at the same time.
That was Trevor Chow Fraser speaking with Craig Isakow. Craig is part of WegoWise, a web-based startup focusing on energy efficiency for buildings.
And now for this week's What's Happening, our weekly roundup of events coming up across the country. If you've got a climate change project that could use a little help, it just so happens that some UConn college students are looking for something to do this summer. The Northern Environmental Change and Community Adaptation Field School is offering to help collect, document, and analyze information for climate change projects in the territory. Interested parties will need to submit a project proposal in order to be considered, and the application deadline is March 21st.
A little further south, the Young Agrarians will be hosting a spring mixer and sleepover at the Seven Springs Camp and Retreat Center in Nanoose Bay on March 22nd and 23rd. If you're a Vancouver Island agrarian in your salad days, this is a great opportunity to swap seeds, trade tips, and field ideas with a few of your fellow farmers. Food and fees are by donation, so bring a dish you'd like to share and give what you can. The 6th annual Gimme Some Truth Film Documentary Festival will be running March 20th to the 23rd at the Cinematique Theatre in Winnipeg, Manitoba. This is a 4-day event bringing audiences and filmmakers together to discuss issues surrounding the documentary form and the effect it has on our culture. Sit in on a panel discussion, masterclass, workshop, or just come by to catch a few flicks. If this is your sort of scene, act now and head to gimmesometruth.ca to get your tickets. If you missed any of the links to more information, they are all available on our website, terrainforma.ca.
And that's the show for this week. Thanks to Trevor Chow Fraser for production and taking care of our website, to Yvette, Hamdi, and Trevor for their stories this week, and to Danielle Dolgoy for coordination. Terra Informa is produced at CJSR in Edmonton. If you have any questions or comments or feedback about the show, shoot us an email at terra@cjsr.com, or you can also follow our Twitter feed at @terra_informa. We've been your hosts, Morgana Folkman
and Yvette Thompson. Join us next week for more thoughtful environmental news from across the country and around the world.